Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
We can work with people who are different than us. We can be friends with people who are different than us. We can love and care about people who are different than us. We can keep people who are different than us safe. We can be good people who care deeply about each other, even when we disagree.
As I traveled around this state, I was so inspired by the many people that I met. And I am convinced Arizona is the best state in the country, and our best days are still yet to come, and I'm going to continue to pray for our success.
I've committed not to advance any more nominees through the Judiciary Committee. We've had hearings for 21. They're awaiting action.
I've been thinking about this moment for almost 2 years now and picturing what that would look like, thinking deeply about what my priorities would be for our education system moving forward. But at the same time, it's surreal.
And with us to talk about the results from Election Day in Arizona as ballot counting is almost done, and Jeff Flake's latest stand in the Senate are John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com, and Sam Richard of Creosote Partners. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Yeah.
John, I have to start with you because I read this brilliant column online. It was at Ricochet.com. It was written by you. The five reasons why Sinema won Arizona. Let's break those down a little bit as we go. And obviously, Sam, jump in on this as you see fit. Negative ad burnout was one. The prevent defense one was I think the most compelling argument. The idea that McSally either didn't do enough or didn't change enough after the primary.
Right. I think one of the real missteps was, yes, you had all those negative ads, but I think McSally was playing not to lose, and you can't really do that in politics. Voters need to see you get out there, mix it up with them, go to hostile environments, go to open town halls where you're, you know, basically taking on all comers. And I think the other thing, too, is just the Pima County effect. When you're trying to get voters in Maricopa County, she really needed to spend a lot more time introducing herself to people. People in this county knew Kyrsten Sinema. They might have disagreed with her, they might have loved her, but they knew who she was. And Martha McSally, to a lot of people who don't follow politics day in, day out, they just weren't sure who she was. And they looked at Kyrsten Sinema, looked at her record in the past couple of years and said, well, she seems nice and moderate, so I'll pull the lever for her.
And Sam, whether Sinema got criticized for saying independent all the time, she defined herself really early, and that seems to be important.
Definitely. And, I mean, I think, obviously, a lot of people tried to paint Senator-elect Sinema one way or another. But the reality is that Sinema will always be as progressive as Arizona allows her to be. She's independent, and she is Arizona in many ways. So, obviously, a lot of my friends on the left were disappointed in some of the things that she didn't say or didn't do in the campaign. But I think that as Arizona continues from this reddish to now purple, and as we continue to go blue, Kyrsten's going to be leading the charge on many policies that will help working families and communities of color.
John, I want to ask you about one of the items that Steve just mentioned, which is negative ad burnout. And it seems like that might go against the conventional wisdom, which is that candidates and campaigns use negative ads because they work. It sounds like maybe you're suggesting that there's sort of a fine line between you should run negative ads because they work, but maybe don't overdo it.
Exactly. When it's basically feels, and yes, McSally had a few positive ads, but it just felt overwhelming anytime I would be at the dentist's office and the TV was on, every ad break was Sinema's a horrible person. Click on a YouTube video to watch a cool music video, which I like to do. My daughter's 14, and she's like, I'm so sick of hearing about how terrible Kyrsten Sinema is, because anytime she got on YouTube, she was just barraged with these ads. So, yeah, McSally needed to give some kind of a positive because, yes, negative ads do work. But people just didn't know who McSally was other than that person who attacks Kyrsten Sinema, and that's not enough.
Yeah, and to that point, we were talking a little bit about that prevent defense argument, and I think that you can run a good prevent defense if you have a solid lead. This race was close from the get-go, and I think that was really a big misstep from the McSally campaign.
Sam, to the idea of Martha McSally not really being as well-known in Maricopa County as in Pima County because she represented that area, I think to John's point about how, you know, she didn't really introduce introduce herself. You know, people didn't really know who she was. A lot of the ads were negative, whereas Kyrsten Sinema sort of talked about her time in Congress and her family and all. How much of that do you think was due to the fact that McSally had a much more competitive primary where she couldn't really spend the time that Sinema did introducing herself to voters statewide?
I mean, I think that was a huge point, and also that definitely ties into the fact that she really didn't make it a point to pivot into that general election stance, right? She took that competitive primary mindset into that competitive general, but it was just a different mindset. It was a different attitude. And whereas Kyrsten had the opportunity to really do that narrative work from, you know, I think March of last year almost, it felt like she was on TV with these like really important and in-depth stories of herself and how that story of self was going to translate to the story of us. And McSally never had the chance to do that.
I don't know that I actually saw any ads that said this, John, but it really reminded me of, we talked a lot about with John McCain passing, that was Governor Ducey going to appoint someone special to that seat? Does a person who runs for that seat need to have something special in and of that, in and of him or herself? It Kyrsten Sinema seemed to run like someone who thought about Barry Goldwater, who thought about John McCain, maybe not people always beloved, but people who made huge impacts here as sometimes crossing the aisle. And I feel like that was sort of an angle that worked for her as well.
Yes, and I think in a lot of her statements, she really called on that. You know, even if she didn't directly invoke McCain's name, she was sounding the same notes that everybody was saying when he was diagnosed with cancer and after he passed. She was just sounding a lot of these notes about unity, disagreement is okay, we're all in this together. And I think going back too to McSally in the primary, one thing that hurt her as well is she was, people thought she wasn't pro-Trump enough during the primary, and then she overcorrected to belatedly embrace Trump. And what it did is it just annoyed people who like Trump and people who dislike Trump. So it's basically a no-win, and that's why she really needed to spend just a lot more time with that narrative work.
And one more quick thing, Sam. I think it's amazing to me that Sinema, with the registration disadvantage, even from the beginning, was really sort of anointed the front runner, even by just a point or two. And I think that also shows to some extent, I wonder what you think in terms of strategy, was that something that she almost had to feel the anointing herself in order to run a campaign this solid?
Yeah, I definitely don't think that she took anything for granted in this campaign, to be sure. But and I think where some of that anointing attitude might have come from was the fact that if you combine the Democratic registration plus the independent registration, there is an advantage there. And I think that was a big factor here. And I think just one solid line that I try to live by is that party registration is not party identification. And we saw that. And as we get the further results, once everything closes out, we'll see that a lot more Republicans voted for Senator-elect Sinema, then Democrats cross the line to vote for Martha McSally.
Well, Sam, what do you make of the fact that as the votes have been counted, Democrats almost up and down the ticket were excited about big ballot numbers coming in from Maricopa County, thinking that was really going to help them, whereas, you know, traditionally, this county is seen as, you know, center-right, maybe not as far to the right as some of the rural counties, but definitely not pro-Democrat.
Right. I think one of the biggest takeaways for me there is that 2020 is when all of our county elected officials are up. So if I was a Republican elected official in Maricopa County, I would be very concerned about my chances for a smooth re-election in 2 years.
What do you make of the fact that is Maricopa County becoming a more purple county?
I think it definitely is becoming more purple. But part of the issue, too, is Arizona is traditionally a purple state. And we've had all the statewide offices were held by Republicans a few years ago. But that was a rare exception. I think what we're seeing now is the pendulum swinging slowly back to center. It's not like this radical shift. We were hardcore red. Now we're hardcore blue. We're naturally just kind of independent-minded, based on the candidate, and Arizonans are not good at taking orders from party bosses, that's for sure.
Sam, is the Sinema template one that other candidates can follow, or is she almost like Janet Napolitano, where she's almost a superstar in her own right?
Well, I think that Kyrsten Sinema is definitely her own politician, and that is to be sure. I think that many politicians should be looking to her playbook and taking some serious notes. But I think in a lot of ways, that race that she ran for the 2018 cycle was a race that will be very different than the one that she runs for her re-election 6 years from now. So it was almost a point in time, and definitely there are some themes that folks should take from that, but I don't think that you can replicate that word for word.
I want to set up my co-host right here and close friend, because he made a fantastic prediction weeks ago that other people have glommed onto.
Oh,
now.
Boy.
Mark, please.
Well, so when Doug Ducey appointed John Kyle to the Senate, some I don't know, cynical people, I would include myself in there, in that category, suggested that maybe this was kind of hedging a bet so that if Sinema ended up winning, that left John Kyle as leaving the seat at the end of the year, leaving a spot for Martha McSally to be appointed to that seat. There's been some talk about that this week. It was obviously a very close race. A lot of people thought she should be a senator. John, do you think there's any utility to Governor Ducey? Do you think there's something he should be considering, appointing Martha McSally to the seat?
I think her name is definitely in the mix. I certainly have no inside information on it, but she did get almost half the votes, and that speaks well of her. She also, in her credit, this isn't just a rip on McSally thing, she didn't follow Trump's lead with saying, oh, the votes are stolen and this is corrupt. She gave a very gracious concession to Sinema, which she posted online in video form. And so I think she knows that it's not over for her and she might have a chance of this. But I know that Governor Ducey has a lot of good names to choose from.
Yeah, Sam, is it, I mean, what do you think about appointing somebody who just lost an election, albeit a very, very close one and one that we knew was going to be close and ended up being close, to the position, not the same seat, but obviously to the same chamber that she was running and lost for?
Right. Well, look, I'm on the bubble of being a millennial. I mean, I got trophies for like being the water boy for the soccer team. So I'm all about someone who just went through a grueling campaign and losing, having an opportunity to have her name mentioned to the appointment. But I think John is absolutely right in saying that that Governor Ducey has a long list of names of very qualified people who would serve the state very well as a Republican senator in that seat. Congresswoman McSally is among those. But I think that the precedent that that would set is if you run in a close race, you have the opportunity to get this consolation prize, I think is one that Governor Ducey is weighing very closely.
John, do you think, I mean, obviously, I assume you haven't had this conversation with her, but do you get the sense that McSally might run for this seat at some point or run for something else at some point?
I think she definitely will. I think you can kind of tell when a politician is doing their last hurrah, and being gracious is not one of the things they do. And, you know, she is definitely setting herself up as, yes, I know it was a negative, dirty campaign, but we're all friends now. The campaign's over. Congratulations to Kyrsten Sinema. And so she is definitely keeping that open for running for future offices. I think one very damning thing against her was that Maricopa County went for Sinema, Pima County went even larger for Sinema, and that's where they know who McSally is.
Yep. Sam, final thoughts on that?
I agree. How about that for a final thought?
That's Sam Richard. Also here is John Gabriel with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this short break. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Friday Newscap here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Sam Richard of Creosote Partners and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. So, Sam, now that we're seeing the counting continues, now Katie Hobbs is starting to build a comfortable lead in the race for Secretary of State over Steve Gaynor. So is that a surprise that that one is actually closer than superintendent, for example, and what are the odds on there being a Governor Hobbs if she ends up being Secretary of State?
Well, there's definitely a lot to unpack there. And I think I'll start with saying that I think at this moment, and of course the race hasn't been officially called or anything, but mathematically it seems impossible for Steve Gaynor to overcome the lead that Katie Hobbs has. So I think it's safe to say that she'll be working on a transition team towards being the next Secretary of State, that's for sure. And because Arizona does not have a Lieutenant Governor position, the Secretary of State is that next in line. So you're a heartbeat away from the ninth floor. You're also, you know, a whisper of political ambition away from being the next governor as well, which I think is the big unanswered question here.
John, what about Steve Gaynor? Was this a case where, I mean, things have gone pretty well for Democrats in some of these statewide races now that we're seeing the numbers? Could Gaynor have done more? I mean, did he think that after destroying the incumbent in the primary, he didn't actually have to tell us anything about himself?
Yeah, I was going to say when you said Steve Gaynor, I was going to say who? Because he did not do a lot. I think, once again, just this campaigning, I think a lot of Republicans just rested on the laurels, said, well, we have a party registration advantage, so we got this. We're the natural heirs. You got to work for it. You know, voters want to see you actually showing that you want the job and mixing it up with them. Steve Gaynor didn't do it. Katie Hobbs did. And this is what happens if you take something for granted. Steve Gaynor, I would call it in the old days, like with Jimmy Carter, the Rose Garden strategy. He doesn't have a Rose Garden, I guess, his gated community. He just stood behind there and said, I'm a Republican, so I'm going to win. That's not enough.
He could have at least had some press conferences at the Rose Garden at the state capitol. Right, I mean, not a ton of roses in there, but they still call it the Rose Garden anyway.
Exactly.
So I'm curious about, we talked a little bit about the vote count earlier. And, you know, Doug Ducey obviously won by a lot. And, you know, Kathy Hoffman, who we'll talk about in a few minutes, looks like she's winning by a fairly comfortable margin at this point. But it wasn't straight down party line. I mean, Doug Ducey won, Mark Brnovich won. It looks like Katie Hobbs is going to win. It looks like Kathy Hoffman has won. So, John, what do you make of the fact that it seems like voters are voters really, like, taking the time to get to know the candidates and think about who they want to vote for as opposed to just voting for a slate of candidates on either side?
It definitely seems like they are. And I think part of it, too, is you had in the past, the left in the state has been somewhat moribund in that. They're like, well, Republicans control everything. Why are we fighting? With the Red for Ed movement and the success that they had, I think you had a lot of people newer to the process who are like, hey, I really want to dig into this and figure out who's good and who isn't. And there was a lot of definitely voting for the person. This was not straight ticket at all. If you look down to the state senator rates, state house rates, races, there was just some really confusing things because you would expect to see, oh, yeah, this – of course, this district went Republican and this one went Democrat, but it was really all over the place.
This has got to be good news for Democrats, right? If people, because with the Republican voter registration advantage, if people are thinking about the particular candidate, not just the party, I would think that's good news for the left.
I think it's definitely not bad news, that's for sure. And I think just to kind of drive home that point about how close these are, it looks like Governor Ducey's reelection is the only statewide race, including the federal race for U.S. Senate, that will be decided by double digits. Every other race will be decided by single digits. And I think that really means that our unaffiliated voters, those independent voters, are really where, you know, a lot of this, you know, the big questions when it comes to the ballot are going to be answered. And, you know, I think it also hints that campaigns still matter, candidates still matter, and I think the issue matters. I think one of the reasons why the Secretary of State race was important is that President Trump has really made voting rights, or at least the diminishing access to the ballot from his perspective, a big marquee issue. So I think having a Secretary of State in that office that will make sure that everyone has full and you know, equitable access to the ballot is going to be important. And then to John's point earlier from the Red to Ed movement, you know, the reason in my mind that that race flipped blue was the Red for Ed movement really highlighted that that's a big race to in that issue.
Sam, because you mentioned the one double digit outcome there,
yeah.
David Garcia has been beaten like a dead horse, and you know he ran a terrible campaign. He was awful. He went too far to the left. Is that fair to some extent without it being personal? Because again, Governor Ducey perhaps had built in some more protections that others did not have. But the fact that he didn't win by 6 or 7, he won very handily.
Right. I think for that race specifically, you're looking at a moderately well-liked incumbent governor, right? And the only reason why he wasn't liked is that a lot of folks didn't know him before, right? But his numbers for approval numbers were always above water. And it really came down to money. It was, you know, a factor of almost 20-1, I think, the Ducey campaign and its allies spent against David Garcia. So right now we're in that midst of everybody's an armchair quarterback and there's been some dueling op-eds and all that good stuff. But I think at the end of the day, you had an extremely strong candidate that was well-financed in Governor Ducey. And then you had some tight races down the ballot.
Let's talk about another race that was called this week, and that is for the superintendent of public instruction. Another race that Democrats won. Kathy Hoffman will be taking office in January. And Sam, we should point out for full disclosure, your firm is helping with the transition.
That's right.
For Ms. Hoffman to take office. She has, as the votes have been counted, her lead is fairly comfortable in terms of number of votes. John, is that surprising to you? Because she was going up against somebody that has run a statewide race before. He was not somebody who was shy about mixing it up with voters and going to public forums and everything like that. They did, I think, 900 different debates together over the course of the election period. So what do you think happened there?
Well, I think what was so interesting about her candidacy, this is the race that surprised me the least, actually. I thought if Democrats would take any office, they had the best chance for just dealing with education. Again, after the Red for Ed movement, also, too, Kathy Hoffman is just a fresh face. You know, I'm kind of conservative libertarian-ish, and every time I saw her spoke, it's like, hey, She's going out there. She's a teacher. She believes in this, and she's passionate. You couldn't complain about her, even if you disagreed with her on the issues. And speaking as an old white guy, you looked at the other side. It was like, meh, old white guy who's been in politics. And, you know, a lot of, especially these, when you go to these lower state offices, a lot of it is just what kind of feel do you get from this person? And I'd rather have lunch with Kathy Hoffman, and even if I disagreed. And I just think she has a very pure message. What's interesting, too, is looking at Diane Douglas in the past 4 years with her, I think Doug Ducey will get along a lot more with Kathy Hoffman than he has with Diane Douglas, despite being from a different party.
And I think to that point, Superintendent-elect Hoffman has already given some of those signals. In some of her first interviews, she's indicated that she wants to work with Governor Ducey because she agrees with the governor, right, that teachers need to be paid more to make sure that everyone in that classroom is achieving what they need to achieve, students, teachers, and the families that support those students. So she's coming in, obviously, as a Democrat with a very clear vision of what she wants to do with that office, but understands that she needs to have a moderate team around her to help work with a power structure that's been in place for quite a while.
How does she do that? Because she's obviously, as John said, brand new to politics. She's somebody who is of the other party from the governor. And superintendent, I mean, for all intents and purposes, is in large part an administrative role. And we saw this with Diane Douglas, where she had some ideas, she had some plans, and they never really went anywhere at the Capitol. So how does Kathy Hoffman try to make sure that her plans go somewhere and that she has the kind of impact and influence down there that she wants to have?
Yeah, so I think just one thing I'll highlight is that in a lot of the lead up into, you know, the superintendent is just an administrative position, but we keep talking about the superintendent of public instruction, and I think that's important, right? I think that the power of the bully pulpit, the power to really move that conversation forward, right? The superintendent has an ex officio seat on ABOR, right? So she'll be a part of the conversations at higher ed, at the State Board of Education, and with the Charter Board as well. So I think that there's a lot of conversations that she can now work with a much tighter margin in the state house, right? We're looking at 31-29 in the state house and a much more moderate state senate than has ever been there before. And we're coming on the heels of where 75,000 people marched on the Capitol to demand, this long list of education reform. So I think that she can definitely be the figurehead and really not even just the figurehead, but really the leader of that conversation.
John, our last couple of minutes, let's wrap up with President Trump's favorite senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake. And after the firing of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, and now the installation of Matthew Whitaker, who has said some things about the Mueller investigation, what do you make of what Jeff Flake's trying to do here in terms of delaying judicial approval and saying unless there's an approval of a bill related to protecting the Mueller investigation, he's not going forward?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. This does show why Jeff Flake decided not to run for re-election. It's one of those things where it seems good in theory and it seems well-intentioned, but I don't really get the utility of it, especially when you have Mitch McConnell, who, you know, I think for fun to get to sleep at night, he reads Robert's Rules of Order. He knows every kind of in and out of Senate law and procedure and precedent. And I'm sure that within a week there's going to be some votes going on. So I think this is kind of one last futile gesture, and I don't really get the point of it. I think he's kind of taking this McCain, hey, let's hold Trump to account, but he's a lame duck senator, and I don't think that lame duck senators have much power.
Sam, does the effort make sense?
No dead air on public radio. Sorry. I think it would have made sense if some of these Senate races went differently, right? I mean, this sounds like maybe an idea that he had if, you know, maybe the Senate race in Florida went differently and that margin wasn't there, right? But his refusal to do anything in committee means absolutely nothing on the floor of the Senate unless he can get some of his colleagues to join him in voting no, which he has shown that he doesn't necessarily have, you know, the ability to whip votes when it's standing up against Mitch McConnell.
So, John, finally, is Jeff Flake, we talked about Martha McSally's political career, is Jeff Flake's political career over? Or as Mark pointed out to me, he made a speech talking about having more relatives in New Hampshire, hopefully. So what do you think his future is?
I think he might dabble in it and test the waters, but I don't think there's a real desire. I just don't see a constituency either in the Republican Party or just an independent electorate for a Jeff Flake for president candidacy. I think he will be, you know, advising people from a think tank or something like that, and maybe that would be a better fit for him. But I really don't see a path forward unless you jump forward 10 years and the landscape changes.
Okay, that's John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com, Sam Richard of Creosote Partners. Always good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.